All right. Call to order the meeting of the Finance Administration Oversight Committee. You have before you the agenda. Are there additions, changes, modifications to the agenda? Without objection, the agenda is approved. Minutes of April 9th, I have a suggestion for one addition, please. Under action item A, we just need the explanation as to why we were doing that. Would you add to accommodate ridership levels above those assumed in the contract? However, we're adding money. I'll read it again. To accommodate ridership levels above those assumed in the contract. That's a parallel to the one below. We gave the reason. Are there any other comments? April 9th, action item, yeah. 2010, right. Metro Access Program Review, right at the very end of the first paragraph.
You're adding the language?
The language to explain why it is that we suddenly added $6.5 million in there.
Could you say the language again? No.
To accommodate ridership levels above those assumed in the contract.
Well, those originally assumed.
Yeah. You wanted the word originally in there? Okay, would you add the word originally? Assume? Any other corrections, changes to the minutes? Without objection, the minutes of April 9th are approved. Brings us to our first item, which is the electricity swap agreement. Ms. Kissel.
Thank you. The purpose of this presentation is to provide us authority to enter into commodity swaps for similar to the swaps, actually, that we execute currently for diesel fuel in order to lock in our budget. The request is for that. On the next page, this one chart actually summarizes the whole presentation. Thank you. Actually, if you don't mind, Committee Chair, Randy Robinson is here, and he's done a lot of work on this, so I would actually move it to have him present this particular chart.
That's fine.
Thank you.
Good morning. About my tardiness, but as Carol said, the item I'm presenting is the electricity commodity swap initiative, and this is a summary of the initiative. As you see, the FY10 budget for electricity is now up to a little over $110 million a year, and that's 886 million kilowatt hours that we consume here at Metro. That's quite a bit of electricity. That equates to roughly 79,000 households, to put that in perspective. How we currently purchase electricity now is in the deregulated markets for D.C. and Maryland. We deal with retail suppliers. And in Virginia, which is not deregulated, we just stick with the utility rates. Right now, because of the volatility of the market, our contracts are generally 6 months to a year. The proposed purchasing method is getting access to the wholesale market. We use the regional market index to set the price for electricity. For us to gain access to the wholesale market, we have to utilize what's called a load-serving entity. All those load-serving entities have been approved by Pennsylvania, Jersey, and Maryland, which is the grid, to be in the wholesale market. We're not part of that. We have to utilize one of those load-serving entities to get to the wholesale market. American PowerNet is that conduit for Metro to get into the wholesale market. The commodity swaps are going to be similar to what we have currently used for diesel fuel. We're going to use the same process for electricity. But this is our first venture in electricity. And then what we're hoping to ensure is budget attainment by doing these commodity swaps. We're going to fix prices when the market is below budget. And the potential savings is anywhere from 5 to 15% compared with what we get on the retail pricing side. So we're looking to save even more than we're saving now by going this route.
Okay, before you go on to the next one, can I ask a couple questions?
Sure.
On that one? This is then, if this is the same thing as we're doing in diesel. It's a derivatives transaction, right?
Right.
So we are doing a trade separate from the actual purchase.
Correct.
And you're not asking us in this action to approve the actual purchase. You're asking us to approve only the derivatives transaction.
Right. That's correct.
Okay. And the price that you have all the way at the top, that's what you expect to pay after this or in the market? In other words, is that what you're going to really spend on power,
we're
or is that what you're going to do after you've done the savings because of the derivatives?
We're hoping to come in under that number. Okay. And that's what we budgeted.
All right. So,
or after we do the swaps, we're hoping that the market the way it is now is we'll be under budget.
You're going to at least tie it to that number and get it there or lower.
Right. That's correct.
If I look at 5 to 15% of that number, that seems to be more than 3 to 9 million.
I think there's just a clarification.
Right. That is the total electricity budget. That includes Virginia's expenses, which are not going to be part of this. It also includes the distribution fees that we will still pay Pepco or BG&E that aren't not going to be subject to the commodity swap. Okay, so the actual dollars that will be in this swap are anywhere from 65 to 70 million.
Okay, so it's 5 to 15% of a smaller number.
Of the smaller number,
approving
right.
a swap for that smaller amount.
Right, that's correct. Thank I just put the total budget up there to give you an idea.
Okay.
And our goal is to be hopefully significantly under that.
Okay. Any other questions? Go ahead.
Next week. A little more detail.
Let me just ask a question. Do we need to have all of the detail here, or do we want to? We've got a lot of items going here.
I'm ready.
We're fine. Okay.
I can vote on this one.
Are we ready to move on this item?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We're ready to move on the item. I'd like to make at least two changes before we move on it. One is we were repeatedly told that this action would be done at or below budget. I'd really like to see that in the resolution, that the swap will be carried out at or below budget. Make sure that we have that there. It's not one of the provisions that's in there. And the other thing is, when you bring this to the board, would you please revise the EAIS, which makes it look like we're approving the entire purchase as opposed to a swap? All the numbers there and everything else there ought to relate to a swap, not to the overall purchase of fuel.
Yes, we'll make the clarification to say that we're looking to do the derivative on the power generation only, not the tariff.
And all the numbers shouldn't even relate to the total cost of power generation. It's really the savings that the swap will result in.
Right.
This makes it look like we're approving 2 years' worth of purchase of power. The words don't say it, but all the numbers do. So if you can bring the numbers in line with the words, that would be good.
Okay.
Are there any other suggestions? Mr. Zimmerman.
I move the committee recommend approval of the resolution with the additions that you just described.
Second.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Next item. Thank you, sir. We're now doing the Metro Matters bond issue. Mr. Zimmerman. Raj?
There he is. Good morning. Earlier this year, we received approval from the board to negotiate the terms of the Metro Matters bonds, which we have done now, and we are seeking final approval from the board to issue the bonds and execute the required agreements. The amount of the bonds is lower than what we had told the board earlier because all of the Virginia jurisdictions agreed to pre-fund. That's why the amount of the debt issuance is lower. This and the next slide both pertain to our summaries of the Metro Matters program. The first slide, which we just went past, summarized the expenses. This is about $2.7 billion plus about $23 million in financing expenses for a total of $2,689. And the next slide talks about the sources of the funding. As you can see on the bottom row, there's a shortfall of $422 million, which is going to be funded by debt and the contributions by the jurisdictions. This lists all of the Virginia jurisdictions which opted out, so the total opt-out amount is 115 which lowers the need to about $307 million plus an estimated cost of issuance of about $33 million for a total bond issuance amount of $340 million. Again, the first half of the slide pretty much summarizes what you saw on the previous slide, and the uses of the bond proceeds will be to repay the existing commercial paper and to fund new capital acquisitions. This is the last debt issuance of Metro Mattress, and consistent with what we had told the board in our previous presentation, we did meet with the rating agencies, and Standard & Poor's did upgrade us from an A minus to an A, and we believe that will, with that upgrade, we should be able to achieve about $2 million of savings.
Roger, could I stop you right there?
Yeah.
There are no credit enhancements that are available anymore.
There are. We're still looking at that. I mean, there are still two bond insurance companies out there, Assured and Berkshire Hathaway. We're finalizing our analysis whether it's cost-effective to go without enhancement or with enhancement. Okay. Whichever one is cheaper, that's what we'll do.
So you will still be looking at that?
Correct.
Okay.
This and the next slide is just a comparison of the, what the current realities are compared to what the assumptions were in the Metro Mattress bonds. As you can see, right now we are just doing one tranche or one issuance of the bonds. The Metro Mattress agreement contemplated that we would issue debt in six different tranches. Again, this assumes a level debt service of $25.4 million per year, and in the Metro Mattress we had what we call a sawtooth, if you will, debt service assumptions, anywhere from 12 to about $232 million in one fiscal year. Even the amount of debt issuance, right now we plan on issuing a maximum of 340. Metro Mattress contemplated about 611. And the term there, that's a not to exceed term, and the average life is, we think, will be approximately 15.7. And the average interest rate, we think, will not exceed 5.5%. But if we were to price it today, it could be a little bit lower, but we'll be pricing it on June 1. So there again, it's a not to exceed interest rate number.
Can you give us a sense that if it were an A-rated going out today, what the interest rate would be?
It'll be approximately 5%. And about a month ago, it was about 5.3. The market seemed to have settled down a little bit, but a lot of things can happen in 2 weeks. And the total debt service now is $635 million. That's undiscounted, as opposed to $858 million, which was in the Metro Mattress. Again, we are seeking approval to issue in an amount not to exceed $340 million, with an average interest rate not to exceed 5.5%.
Pretty much so. Mr. Lenton.
I'm not quite sure who... question. Who's our current FA, financial advisor?
PFM.
PFM?
Correct.
Okay. Who are the underwriters that are going to be assigned to this issuance?
There's a syndicate of seven underwriters, Goldman Sachs, Bank of America, Wachovia, and the three minority firms, plus JP Morgan Chase.
Who are the three minority firms?
Mesiro Capital, Cabrera Capital, and Siebert Shank.
Any other questions? I'm very pleased that the number came down so far from where it was the first time this was proposed to us. But we're really going for a much lower debt level than we first saw it. Can we have a motion to approve this
question?
I'm sorry. Is anybody?
On page 20, the uses of funds are shown of the total, which 24% or $653 million is project management.
That is correct. That's exactly what was contemplated in the Metro Mattress agreement.
Does that seem high to me?
Project management is a broad definition that includes a number of other things, including pre-Metro Mattress capital projects that were running to completion. So any CIP project that was in effect before the start of Metro Mattress got lumped into that category. So it's not just management salaries.
So what's it paying for in those things?
It's paying That was when we converted from the obligation to the expenditure basis of budgeting. So the expenditures on those pre-Metro Matters projects...
Of any type?
I'm sorry?
Of any type, not just administrative expenditures, but...
Right, it's the real capital project cost.
How much of that $653 million is that?
The vast majority of it, I can get you the specific
majority.
Number. A huge majority of that is for real bricks and mortar capital projects.
Actually not paying for Metro Matters, but paying for other
previous
capital. So that's maybe not the best way to display it.
Correct. It was just a label that got stuck on the thing when the Metro Matters agreement was originally prepared, so we've tried to be consistent labeling throughout.
Okay.
One other item, just a clarification. This debt, when issued, will be Metro debt, WMATA debt, correct?
That's correct.
None of it will be D.C. debt or Maryland debt, and I guess there isn't any Virginia debt. Is that correct?
That is correct. Then.
Make sure that as we do the paperwork, that that's abundantly clear, that there is, you know, that this is entirely Metro debt and in no way affects any of the jurisdictions.
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah.
Mr. Zimmerman? Yes and no. It actually does affect the jurisdiction. I think I understand the sense in which you mean it, but the obligation to repay falls on those obligations, on those jurisdictions that have not opted out of the obligation.
Correct, but we do not have a situation where the debt reaches through and becomes part of the debt ceiling for the individual jurisdiction.
I understand, although that's really between those jurisdictions and their bond rating agencies. It's not really a Metro matter.
I just want to make sure that this is a Metro debt and is labeled as a Metro debt and not as a D.C. debt or a Maryland debt. And yes, we do understand that those that have opted out will not pay any part of the interest or the print.
The statement says in a number of places that the bond is not the debt of the jurisdiction.
Thank you. That's the only thing we're looking for.
And actually, the official statement is in the package that was delivered to the committees for your review. It's been modified slightly, but...
Even on the cover page, we state that it's not an obligation of the U.S. government or the jurisdictions.
Thank you.
Okay.
I want to make sure that's there. Motion to approve?
Second.
Okay. We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
That one is approved. Next item, public comment on federal fiscal year 2010 annual disadvantaged business enterprise goal. Mr. Navarez. No? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Zimmerman. Jorge Navarez is going to be giving a presentation about our request to for authorization to go to public comment for our annual disadvantaged business enterprise. Jorge is also joined by Corey Gray, who's with our DBE office as well.
Good morning, Mr. Benjamin and members of the board. Next slide, please. Our purpose here this morning is an action item to initiate our 45-day public comment period for the proposed Metro DBE goal. As you know, this is a requirement by the Federal Transit Administration. Next slide, please. We're obligated under our Code of Federal Regulation 49 CFR Part 26 that all recipients must submit an annual DBE goal to the FDA by August the 1st. And as part of that, annual certification is necessary to receive our grant funding. Next slide, please. Our proposed 2010 DBE goal is 25% of the anticipated federally supported contracts awarded by Metro in fiscal year 2010. We are splitting that 25% in two ways. 19% of that goal is achieved by setting specific project goals for DBE firms, and 6% of the annual goal will be achieved through other means, including encouraging more DBE firms to participate on Metro projects without the use of project-specific goals. In addition, we will support every effort of DBEs to become prime contractors, which is one of the primary goals of this program, on any Metro projects. And we will continue our business development and outreach programs to enhance the Metro DBE participation in contracts. As you can see from this graph, our goals have been exceeded almost every year. We are anticipating or forecasting that we will achieve this year for our fiscal year 2009 a 25% goal DBE participation. I wanted to note that these figures here do not represent funding by the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, which are excluded here and will be calculated separately. Next slide, please.
Mr. Lynn.
Any questions?
Is that separation required? Is that a requirement of reporting by the FTA?
Yes, sir. We seek public comment beginning May 28th and ending on July 13th, and a public meeting is set for June the 30th. We will be returning to you on July 16th for the approval of the DBE annual goal. And thank you all for your support of the DBE program.
This is an action not to approve the goal, but to go to public comment.
Yes, Mr. Bennett.
Go
ahead. One, thank you all for your achievements in prior years, but I also want to know, is the two-step process that you laid out, is that one that we've used in the previous year?
Yes. And we continue to expand our outreach efforts throughout the metropolitan area within our compact zone.
So the data has been successful, so that's good. One other question. When we talk about our DBE program here, we're talking specifically about federally funded programs?
Yes, sir. Federally funded.
In the course of your office, how does your office either influence or track non-federal programs? I know we have made a very aggressive effort in the real estate area to try to put some language in there that relates to participation, and that's outside of the federal programs per se, but does your office in its administration and review and encouragement have any relationship to those non-federal programs?
Well, in this instance, we're talking about federally funded programs, the DBE firms. However, we do, through our outreach efforts, support and encourage our small and local business development programs that Metro has. And we work very closely with Maryland, the district, and Virginia in also encouraging some of those firms to work with us. In other words, most of our outreach efforts, procurements, also include information, detailed information about some of our small and local business development programs.
That wasn't quite the answer to the question. But it's a good effort. Now, I'll restate the question. The question is, we have a DBE program that's pretty much a requirement of federal statute.
Mm-hmm.
However, all of our money that we expend is not federally specific. We have money that's basically governed by local revenue. You mentioned the way that your response was we do outreach efforts to try to encourage in those areas. My question was, does your office responsibility extends to those areas in terms of monitoring, measuring, and determining how we're doing in non-federal areas? I know the federal requirements suggest that
right.
We have to report to them in those areas, but that does not prohibit us from having some insights on how we're doing outside of that.
I'm going to let Mr. Corey Gray respond to that, please.
Essentially, the direct answer to your question is no. The DBE office does not formally monitor and report on non-federally supported contracts. However, as part of our advocacy work for our certified firms, we do track the non-federally supported contracts just to make sure that our certified firms still get ample access to those opportunities as well. But as part of our formal monitoring and reporting process, we don't have a direct connection to that.
And let me add one item, actually, in answer. This might answer part of your question. The state and local business promotion, whether it's federal or non-federal, is actually coordinated through the procurement office. And there's a group there that actually promotes the promotion of state and local small businesses. We can certainly bring that report to the committee At another time, maybe at the next month's committee or the one after that. I don't have it currently with me.
That's good, but that still doesn't get to, and I think it's something I'm interested in seeing, because I think I'd like to see some consistent application. Even though we are only required by the federal program, it may be helpful to know how we're doing with non-federal dollars. Mm-hmm. I mean, ultimately, the objective of this program, when it was instituted initially, was that it would go away, and that there would be some efforts that will take place in programs that are not federally funded. I would like to get a sense of how we're doing in those areas. I think we should try to structure our program to do that. Two, we've also extended this program into, as I suggested earlier, into real estate with joint developments. And I understand that, crossing and all the laws and all the requirements are there for what you can and cannot do. But none of those laws prohibit you from doing monitoring and reporting. So I think it would just be helpful if we knew kind of metro-wide how we're doing, what we're doing. I raised a question recently in the most recent presentation on our bond presentation that we had before, and I don't know if we monitor how we're doing on professional services side. I just think it's helpful for us to know as a property how we're doing in diversity in our contracts across the board. Mm-hmm.
And we will do that. I think you will find that the numbers I think they look pretty good, but again, that's a report we will put together and bring back to you.
Ms. Healy? Okay.
Well, thank you. I think it's all been said by Mr. Linton, but I would just like to point out that I strongly echo his statements and concerns that we would like to have corresponding information regarding the non-federally funded contracts as well. I think that's imperative to see and to have it on a regular basis as well. Mm-hmm. If we don't have a corresponding goal, I'd like to see how we're doing and how we're pursuing this and how active and how committed we are and successful we are.
We will do that.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk about your next steps and really premised on what your success rates are. Can you give us a breakdown when you come back as to participation by jurisdiction?
Absolutely.
That is, what are you seeing out of the other, out mm-hmm. of all of our compact areas?
I just wanted to add, during our public commentary period, we're continually encouraging DBE firms to provide us with feedback. They actually do that through emails and as part of the process. They're always giving us feedback. So we will definitely split that into jurisdictions and bring that back to you. Thank you. The next slide. Our recommendation is for the board to please authorize the 45-day public comment period for the proposed 2010 DBE goal. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions?
Motion. So moved, Mr. Chairman.
And seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Navarez. Stack. This is establishing a reimbursable project for the neutral host project. Item for the neutral host project.
Next slide, please. In February, the board authorized the neutral host process, which is going to allow wireless communications in all of Metro stations and tunnels with a single set of equipments for all of the carriers. The project is on a 4-year schedule, and the intent of the project was that this neutral host be built at no expense to Metro. Because it was our intention to take no expense, we are coming today to ask the board to establish a carrier-funded cost recovery account which the carriers will fund to take all of the expenses that historically Metro would have taken. All of the expenses like escorts, like flagmen, like project managers, like power, we want and have contracted to have all of those expenses recovered. Next. We have, we believe that those expenses will be almost $2.4 million. That is $2.4 million that historically Metro would have borne, that the carriers will bear. Contractually, we have asked that the cost recovery account that you will authorize today will never have less than $100,000 in it. And as I say, over a four-year period, we believe we will have returned to us $2.4 million. Next slide. So we ask today that in the 2010 budget, you establish a line item cost recovery account that allows us to dump the carrier money in and accept it into Metro.
Questions?
What you call the carrier team, which is the four major wireless providers are involved. Those are Verizon, Sprint,
AT&T, Nextel, AT&T, and T-Mobile.
How much of the wireless business do they have?
In Washington, D.C., they have it all.
That's 100%. Mm-hmm. If you have a cell phone, it's with one of those. Mm-hmm. And we had the 20 busiest stations done as of October 2009. Mm-hmm. And we will have had them done as of October 2009. Mm-hmm. Does that mean that, as a practical matter, in those 20 stations, by October, anybody with any of those services, mm-hmm. which is the non-Verizon service, will be able to use them?
Right.
And that 1 year later, in all underground stations throughout mm-hmm. the region, they'll be able to use an AT&T or T-Mobile or Sprint.
All of those carriers' frequencies will be, the wireless frequencies will be supported.
And remind me how this affects any other wireless services.
What do you mean?
Does it affect the ability to use a laptop? And that kind of
thing? It has no effect on that.
It's only related to those that are essentially phone-based. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, to the extent that you have internet and phone, obviously, but what people call Wi-Fi is a separate status. Mm-hmm. And that's something we're still looking at. I remember
absolutely. I brought as well, I thought you might be interested just in hearing a quick naming of those 20 places in which by October.
Sure.
Union Station, Metro Center, Farragut North, Palm Circle, Farragut West, Lompoc Plaza, Gower Chinatown, Foggy Bottom, McPherson, Pentagon City, Pentagon, Roslyn, Crystal City, Boston, Smithsonian, Bethesda, Federal Triangle, Judiciary Square, Friendship Heights, and Archives.
Can we get that list distributed?
Yeah.
Email that to everybody. I'm sure the people on that table are going to want it also.
Yeah.
And then, finally,
Mr. Zimmerman, may I stop you for just a second, just for clarification on what you were just asking? When this is in operation in those stations, will it be in operation between those stations? In other words, will we be able to use our phones in the tunnels between the stations that are identified?
No, you will be able to use them in the stations only.
So you're saying we will lose our signal as we leave the station?
That's correct.
Until October 2012.
Remember, it will be five months from the time the contract is signed till October 16th. That's really very, very good work to have.
And what is then the priority to get it between those stations? Is that the next highest priority?
Yes, then there's the full build.
Well, but full build could be all sorts of different priorities. You could wire other stations instead, or you could focus on getting it between those stations so that it becomes more useful.
Right. We're going to focus on highest usage highest volume first.
Stations or tunnels?
After the stations, tunnels.
Okay, but that, I'm still not quite getting the answer I'm looking for. There are 20 stations, then there are a whole bunch of other stations. Is connecting between the stations a higher priority than doing additional stations? Which one is higher?
It is a mixture, and I'd be happy to get you the priorities as we have them then.
I do think that we're going to have a lot of very frustrated customers if they're on trains and they're getting and losing signals as they go into and out of stations. And although the Congress asked things in certain words, what we're really trying to do is get a system that's useful for our customers and not necessarily be responsive to the words as written in that law, relative to which I do think we need to be very careful about the wording that we use in our resolution and elsewhere. We say we need to do this to qualify for. No, the law requires that this happen, but we don't need to do this to qualify for. So I think we need to reword our resolution just to say that the law requires that this happen. But I think we need to take a broader view, a customer-centric view, and make sure that we focus on being able to get a signal anywhere in the downtown area and among those 20 stations, and make that at least as important, if not more important, than the spread to the other stations.
Absolutely. We are not, you can be sure that we're not going to do piece parts. We're not going to give you a service in a high volume station and then dangle you between that station to another high volume station. So customer centric is absolutely a priority, and building outward connectively is a priority as well.
Thank you, Ms. Payne. Mr. Linton.
Accompanying your comment, Mr. Chairman, I think it's also important that we provide good information to try to mediate some of the complaints and concerns that people will have by being disconnected in between stations. So I think it's important for public information for people to know that you will have service at the stations, and at a certain date we will hopefully be able to connect you through the tunnels, but we don't want to build in frustration for people who this big announcement that we now have connections with your cell phones, and all of a sudden people begin to realize through their application that they're getting disconnected within the stations, within the tunnels. So we need to make sure that we do that.
Yeah, a couple things. One, that was one of the points I was going to make, is communicating with people. Of course, while there may be frustrated customers who lose signal when they leave a station, today all of our customers virtually are frustrated because they have no signal at all. So even a signal in a station is a big improvement over what we have today. But again, communicating that to people is going to be important. We don't want them to think that once they establish a signal in a station that we're done, that this is a project that's going to take a number of years to get fully implemented. And during that time frame, there's going to be breaks in service in between different areas. And that's something that has to be communicated with folks, that we're not wiring the whole thing, waiting to turn it on until the entire system is wired, that it actually will be activated as we complete certain pieces of the project. And communicating that is going to be critical. The one question I had is I guess I didn't get the complete answer to what Mr. Zimmerman was asking about with Wi-Fi. Does anything that we're doing in this action make establishing Wi-Fi either easier or more difficult in the future?
It makes it easier. Wi-Fi simply operates on a different frequency than cell phones operate on. This equipment will allow a very, very broad spectrum of frequencies and will make it much easier.
So there's no chance of us hearing in the future that as a result of this action somehow we complicated a
no
Wi-Fi
chance.
Implementation in the future.
No chance.
Thank you.
Mr. Zimmerman?
Just on the previous point on communication, I appreciate Mr. McKay's clarification. But on this question about communication, we have a schedule that's right here, that we were shown, with three key milestone dates, two of which are those that are federally mandated, one for October 2009 and the 20 busiest stations, that is language from the federal bill, and the entire underground system, October 2012, is also from that. In between, we are told here that all underground stations were done by October 2010. So I think that it's going to be important to communicate that information over and over again. That is the schedule, and that it is what is required by Congress. Because you could have made a different set of choices about how you move the system, as Mr. Benjamin was suggesting, but we are bound by these two points that have to be specified in federal legislation, so that's what's going to happen. Hopefully, we can indeed make those dates. This is obviously very aggressive, as you were noting.
Following up on Mr. McKay's comment, at the present time, you can at least get Verizon sometimes somewhere. So in the stations and in some portions of some tunnels, you can usually get Verizon. Will that still be active while this is going in so that
absolutely
not be taking anything away from our customers?
Right. That is an entirely separate wireless system, and it maintains during the whole 4 years of this build.
At the end of which it will be taken out?
At the end of which it probably won't be taken out, and at the end of which, if Verizon still would like to operate it separately, they may do so.
But we are never going to get into a situation where we're reducing the
current
access that our customers have from where they are today.
Absolutely not.
It'll just be improved incrementally, and we will be thinking about the connectivity as we go through this process.
That's correct.
Any other comments? Motion to approve.
So moved.
Seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Ms. Zeman, open payment system.
And Mr. Chair, if I might, before she makes the presentation, given there's been a lot of press on this issue, I just want to make clear what this is and what this is not. This is a request for proposals. This is not an award of a contract. Based upon the articles, when you read some of those, someone might think that we are awarding a contract today, and we're not doing that. We're getting the proposals. Any proposals that come in will be reviewed by staff, and we will bring it back to the board for a decision on what direction to go.
So I understand correctly, this is even one step less than that. It's a request for proposals, which will then narrow down the opportunity, and there will be another request for proposals after that. So we're two steps away from actually getting to the point where we're likely to award to anybody. Is that right?
Correct.
Mr. McKay.
Just one additional further clarification on some of the stuff I've read. This is not a system that will replace the Smart Trip system. That actually, in the language of the RFP, this is a system that would supplement and offer an option to folks, but in no way, shape, or form is this designed to or intended to immediately replace the Smart Trip card that we've invested so much in the past on. So, I think that's an important clarification. This is not a replacement.
And it's not a replacement for our regular fare cards.
Right.
It's in addition to.
Right.
Mr. Linton?
And you said immediately. I want to make sure that we specify immediately. That's important to be communicated, but I also want to make sure that we make it very clear that potentially it could.
Over the long term.
Over the long term. And we need to make sure that that's part of how we're viewing this. Is that agreed to?
I think that's the board's intent. Ms. Hudgens.
And I guess I wanted the clarification even greater than that. And our concern is that we, in that area of time frame in which we progress, should we do so, system. It is a system that will allow the integration into a new system that will not the process that we've had before. For example, we've lived through the migration of the Smart Trip card and the sole and primary source that has driven the ability for us to progress through that. That this RFP drives the respondents to a product that will give us a truly either for a period of time, an alternative that is on par or a well-integrated one that will allow all the jurisdictional systems to continue. I think the idea is really progressive in what we want to do, but I think we want to make sure that we are building upon a foundation of integration and uniformity throughout the system that we have. So that's one of the key I think we need to make sure happens.
I think the consistent message that the board is sending is this is an addition to, not a replacement of, and everything that is out there now must continue to operate as it has in the past. And this will just provide yet one more opportunity for people to have a more positive experience when riding our system. And over the long term, some of these things may start to go away, but that's a separate issue.
And I think that separate issue part becomes the one that we really need to keep our eye on, and that is that separate issue does not change what we have eventually built up in terms of the uniformity of the system. That is, a new product that works partly, say, on the Metro internal system and does not work in the jurisdiction will not be an acceptable product.
Well, absolutely.
Right. Yeah. That is, make it everywhere. Mr. Albert.
Thank you. Do you know if there are any other transit systems that are accepting bank cards and what their experience has been?
Yes, we do. Would you like me to go ahead and go through the presentation?
That's in her presentation.
Actually, you're hitting on all the parts that I was going to hit on, so thank you.
Before you start, let me just check. Mr. Linton, are you okay? You were ready to say something here.
I was going to answer the question.
Go right ahead.
And I'll be very kind, but I think, you know, there have been, the JCCs had a presentation that was provided to them almost 7 to 8 months ago, even longer, that was actually more thorough than this one. So I think, actually what the board is getting is not the extent of what they should be getting as it is going forward. And I think one of the things that we will probably want to do, because I think there is a two-part process that's been defined here, and I think this was somewhat approached with some of the questions that have been asked. The language in the RFP, or request for proposal, really requires a great deal of thought and scrutiny, because I think some of the concerns that have been expressed, how you ask for this is how you will get it. And it's very important that the language reflects the kind of thought that's exhibited here in this board. And I think that, I don't necessarily as a rule suggest that board members look at RFPs, but I do think that there are some inherent concerns here that need to be expressed within those RFPs. And we've not been real good as a system. WMATA has not been, our track record in fare systems, management and review has not been great, be real candid. And, you know, our own IG reports have reflected on that. And I think, some of the board's concerns reflect on that. So I think there's a great deal of both interest and concern that we do it right. So I just want to express that fairly straightforward.
Seaman, do you want to have a chance to give your presentation?
Sure.
Oh, I didn't
probably
answer the question.
Oh.
Yes. There are several transit systems that are actually pursuing this right now. Utah has a system up and running, and UTA. So they actually have been operating a bank card system, and they've gone system-wide. MTA in New York has had a pilot operating on their Lexington line for the last 2 years. That pilot has been expanded to both include PATH, which is the railroad, and all the trains on PATH, some of the buses at MTA, and also some of the buses at New Jersey Transit. So they're actually making this a full-blown test on a regional basis with all modes, including both distance-based fares as well as those are singular-based fares. And they've used both key fobs and will probably also use some cell phone stickers. So that is one that's in operation. Chicago is actually probably going to be moving towards something similar, including all of their properties, the RTA, the CTA, and to some degree with handhelds from Metro. There are LAMTA in Los Angeles has already started with a kind of a dual card that will have both a computer chip and their smart chip in their TAP program. There are several other properties that are, Cincinnati has looked at this off and on with one RFP going out and retracted and another one going out most recently. And there are several others that are in discussion that I won't reveal right now. But this is very much looked at as the next wave of fare system. And I think the presentation that's here clearly indicates that one of the great aspects of it is that it allows us to get out of all of the management issues that related to cars. It puts a tremendous amount of the responsibility on that to the banking community, who has already started with contactless chips in their cars. Some of you may have bank cards right now, and sometimes you don't even know it, that already have the contactless chip with the antenna that's already embedded in your cards. The banking community has already started to do that. And there are also other avenues for getting at the unbanked, which is always an issue of this, with things such as prepaid cards. There's also co-branded cards. There are various ways in which one can make sure that the card distribution, all the issues that relate to this that we have to deal with, gets taken away from the authority and that it's managed by others. The other thing is that the core of the fare system that you purchase and buy in order to do this is no way as elaborate as the kind of investment in infrastructure that we currently invest. And you also finally get to the point where you have some standards where you can get interoperability and get away from proprietary information. That the system operates on bank standards, which are international standards, which are standards that are in fact certifiable because everybody's operating under the same standards internationally. And the core of the system is one in which you're using transit agency, WMATA becomes a merchant. So you just become just like Macy's, Sears, and any other merchant. You are in fact becoming a merchant and participating in the international credit network of merchants. So that's how the system works. And finally, interoperability. You get a system that allows you to go from one system to the other because you use your bank card. You don't need a smart card. And the core of that is that you're not creating a bank. You're not creating a separate currency. The way we operate now, we're in a closed system. That we have a smart card is only used, only good for WMATA. It has no other value outside of it. When you go to the open payment system, you're now connected to the international credit network, so you're using your same vehicle that you use to purchase your gas, to purchase your clothes, to purchase food, will access your transit services. And I will close with also the fact that you also be able to use same type of payment on tolls. Because many of you may know that Easy Passes and some of the other things that you're using are all traced to a credit card. And also some of the on-street parking facilities now are also being able to take bank cards with antenna and chips. So the idea of having a interoperability transportation payment system that goes throughout the system is possible with this. Just shortly.
I think we've established that is reasonably knowledgeable in this area. Many of us are very, very much supporting this concept, and I think actually the whole board has indicated very clearly that it is supportive of this. And the general manager wants to say, I don't know whether
Mr. I was going to say, Mr. Chair, with that presentation, the last two slides. Let's go to the last two slides.
I do think that first slide is particularly important because it does reflect what it is we're trying to do, which is do something for our customers. So
there you go.
Why don't you go ahead and see how much of this presentation is left to give.
Well, okay. Yes, we have hit on all the core concepts that we were trying to focus on. Again, we're coming today just to seek board approval to issue a solicitation to receive, as Peter indicated, the first phase of proposals, which we would evaluate and then narrow down and fine-tune the statement of work based on the concepts that were submitted, and then send the reissue the solicitation again to probably that core group of people who submitted, and then from there narrow it down and see who actually gives us the best concepts and focus on that. And let me just say, too, that some of the concerns that the regional partners have expressed to me so far, and every time this is brought up, are not going to be far from my mind or distant as we look at this. I'm saying my mind, but I think it's for the entire agency. And we will incorporate and use them in this process as well as we can, and in fact, perhaps even have one of them on our evaluation team. And just to make sure that the focus on them is not distant from us. And so certainly having a regional program is what we're also focusing on, too. So it will have to be the interoperability between all our systems. So the idea, we're down to the recommendation. Okay, well, okay. So there we go. Do you really want me to go through anything else?
I had questions.
Okay. Mr. Zimmerman, go ahead.
I think we've established that the Montgomery delegation is the Vermont Board on this topic. I have a couple of questions. First is kind of a small one, and it's a bigger one. The small one is this question of sort of credit card refill, which I think Mr. Lynn alluded to. You know, when I get an easy pass to operate on the toll road that functions on the East Coast, it's automatically tied to a credit card, as Mr. Linton said. But it's tied as a financial transaction. Card. It's not tied to the mechanics of the credit card. It simply is linked in, and it's a financial arrangement that when you buy the thing, you signed up for that, so that when the number falls below a level, it automatically puts into your Easy Pass account. And I know this has come before here. I've asked it sometimes in the past about why we couldn't do that, and at some point we hope to be able to do that too. I don't understand what that has to do with this at all. So my question is, why can't we make such an arrangement now within the context of what happens to be a smart card account and Metro fare payment?
Well, I can tell you that as soon as we have the next fare upgrade, which is to be completed at the end of this year, we will have the ability to actually use that and capitalize on that investment that we've made so far in this system to allow even the use of bank cards with just that. But we are in the solicitation. We are going to open it up to look at all possibilities because there may be something that we may not know of. But the existing investment that we're currently making will actually allow the use of bank cards with with the right readers on the buses, as well as the reader software to allow that to happen. So that's one way of looking at it. That's one way it could actually be used.
So, again, I want to be clear, because I thought I understood at the end of last year that this was one of the improvements that was coming as part of the smart card work that's being done now.
That is correct.
So that's completely separate from this.
Yes. This could actually allow – what this is going to do is –
okay, if we don't do this, if we say no today, we don't want to do this thing, decide I don't want to do it at all, am I going to get that refill capacity on my smartphone.
Oh, the refill capacity, absolutely. Yes, the autoload, yes.
Because it's showing up in the stories of some of them I read as if it's about this.
No, it has nothing to do with this.
But that's something that is coming anyway.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, I'm not confused.
Sorry about that.
So now my bigger question. It sounds to me, especially from Mr. Linton's lecture, that there's a whole lot of people getting into this business. That, you know, when we did Smart Trip, we were ahead of everybody else in the country. In fact, we're still ahead of everybody else in the country with only a few exceptions on that particular kind of mechanism.
Mm.
We were out there very quickly and very successfully. It looks to me like now, with this next step, we might not be. It looks like there's a whole lot of people getting out in front on what looks like it'll be the next generation of fair payment. And we have a multi-step request for proposal process. I guess I'm asking this in light of Mr. Benjamin and Mr. Lenton's points. Are we moving kind of slow on this, or is that just a misimpression?
We're moving in a way that we can have a system that works well. We want to bring back the options to the board from a perspective. What is the interest first? Are there people willing to do this? I believe that's yes.
Don't we know the answer to that? I'm sorry, Ms. Gator, but I mean, given that New York's doing it, all these other places are doing it, I guess I don't understand. What is it we need to know?
Can I step in and maybe answer part of that? Because
sure.
The Technology Review Committee, which Mr. McKay is chair, he may want to add to this, has thought this through pretty carefully. And if you go to the chart up there that says goals, you see that one of the first goals that we want to have here is to establish a relationship with banking institutions. This is, although a demonstration is being done in New York, it's being done on only one line, and they're now spreading it. It's 31 stations on Lexington Avenue. Although Utah has this system, Utah's a very small system, and we're looking at something substantially larger. We have to see whether we can really establish a relationship with financial institutions that will, in fact, allow this to occur on the scale that we're likely to do it. And although people like SEPTA and Los Angeles and Chicago are also doing that, I think they're doing it in a somewhat similar fashion. You're discovering some of them are trying to move ahead with a final RFP, but I think this two-step is going to allow us to, or at least that's what the Technology Review Committee believes, is going to allow us to establish that relationship well and then move forward on the very specific stuff of how are we going to implement this in detail. Mr. McKay, do you want to add to that?
No, I completely agree with that. I mean, the concern we've had always is the rollout and the PR and how you communicate with people and establishing the relationship. And so I don't think we're far behind where other agencies are, but I do think that we have to be very careful, given the size of ours, how we put this in place and how we communicate with people, because there will be a lot of confusion. And one of the things we focused on outside of this RFP that the board should be aware of and is important to the board is the communications piece of this with our customer, because the success or failure of this will be directly tied to how we communicate it to our customer. And so I think that's an important part of it. While we're discussing potentially putting out an RFP today at a later time, we're going to have an extensive discussion about how our customers know about this system, how it works, and how we're going to roll it out. And so I think we've been appropriately cautious to this point, making sure that the language in the RFP reflects what I think are the goals of this board and agency. But I don't think we're far behind the other agencies that are mentioned, and I think there's a opportunity to quickly move ahead and get ahead of them should the system work. But I do think that the proper amount of diligence has been done to date to make sure what we're putting out there is actually a system that we want. And so we didn't want to race into something that got us RFP requests. The RFP responses came back, didn't bring us what we wanted. And so we did take the time to go over multiple versions of an RFP in the committee to make sure we didn't have to start over again when the request came back and didn't actually do what we wanted it to do. And so it is a technical issue. It's very involved. I mean, the presentation doesn't really, for good reason, doesn't capture all the nuances of doing something like this. And while the frustration level of customers is pretty high that we don't just do this because they do it everywhere else they go, gas stations, anywhere else they go, the truth of the matter is our system is a whole lot more complicated. The fare structure is different depending on different rides. We have to make sure on day one this is able to be used in all of modes of WMATA, not just rail, but on bus and in other ways. And so it's a whole lot more complicated than the documents show, but I feel like where we are in terms of progression is not out of line with where others are, and I think we have an opportunity here to do it right and also be one of the first transit agencies to implement it system-wide without failure, and that really is the ultimate goal.
I'm glad to see, Mr. Chairman, that the expertise on this issue extends to a Virginia member.
Mr. Lynn.
Well, you know, I can agree and I disagree. I think the devil's in the details. It's clearly how the RFP and even the first RFP, how it's worded and what the intent is. And I should, probably shouldn't say this, but the SEPTA, you know, RFP that's been out on the street has been extremely complicated, and it's gone through five or six addendums, and there's been some confusion as a result of it. I think they're going to end up at a good place, but the nature of the RFP is creating some problems for them. So how the RFP is structured and what its state and what's its goal and how it's going to both be evaluated and what you're going to look for in phase one of the RFP versus the second phase is very important. Also how what you're looking for, you mentioned banks, but there are
financial institutions
is kind of, and that's a broad term in terms of how this gets rolled out. So how that's defined is also extremely important. So the devil's in the details in terms of how this is rolled out. And once again, I'm not quite comfortable that we have what we need to do to be able to do that. And I will be very, very candid. The other thing is the procurement process. In looking at our IG report of our previous experience with smart cards, and I've looked at this across the industry, I'm not sure that the procurement lawyers and attorneys within the transit agencies are up to par with the contractors. We tend to have generalists in our legal staff. The contractors tend to have specialists because this is all they do. Those are in the FAIR systems. All of their attorneys are designed to write contracts and examine contracts based upon technology applications, the control of the proprietary information, and to make sure that they maintain control. We don't usually have in-house, and transit agencies can't afford to have in-house, specialized attorneys who are skilled in both law and technology. And very often, as you structure a contract and making sure that you control the elements within that contract, you need to be able to do that. Otherwise, you become suspect to the control of the contractors. And that's something that I think industry-wide is a problem. And I think that was somewhat expressed in the IG's report in our most previous experience with this. So I'm very concerned that we make sure that we are in control, that we understand all the nuances within those agreements as they go forward to make sure that we protect ourselves long-term. So those are just, you know, some of my own concerns. And I've been looking at this for the last couple of years. I mean, this is something that I do as part of my business interests. So it's something that I'm concerned about that we do better as we go forward with this procurement.
And to assure Mr. Zimmerman, Mr. Giancola is also part of the Technology Review Committee, so DC has got an expert who understands this stuff quite well also and is heavily involved. And one of the issues we've been concerned about is exactly the one that Mr. Linton just brought up. Ms. Hudgens.
We talked about this from a financial standpoint, the financial relationship that we're making. I would just like to have a sense of clarity that as we move toward this in terms of thinking of how the payment occurs, that relationship with the financial industry, that we also are thinking progressively in terms of how our fare system works for people across the system, that is, benefit systems that integrate into this. Because what we would like to make sure that we move to is single payment instrument that allows not only those of us who pay our fare through financial exchange, but there are benefit exchanges that can occur on those cards in a way that they don't occur even on Smart Trip today. And I think if we're going to start this path, that should be a part of what we're looking at. I think there was another comment made about, are we at the lead of this or are we trailing this? And I assume that what we're looking at is that what we're seeing as the current generation is either at the beginning of it or at the end, and we know what the next generation looks like, or we're going to be able to have an opportunity to know what the next generation looks like, because we've left the product that drove us to being captured rather than the ability to be innovated by the way we entered that contract. And I think that's going to be a part that we have to protect ourselves.
That's a very good point. Do we have a motion to approve? Second. Did we have a second?
Yes.
Second. Oh, okay. Thank you. All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Thank you, Ms. Seema. It was a wonderful presentation.
Thank you.
She should have her assistant with her. Just make sure she gets it.
That concludes our action items. We have a capital budget review. We have not so far really looked at anything other than the Metro Matters portion of our budget, and Ms. Kissel is going to broaden that for us at this moment, because we are now, I think, effectively done with most of the operating. We'll have some more on revenue and ridership. We have to tie up the capital, and then next month we're looking forward to approvals of our budgets. So, Ms. Kissel.
Thank you. And as Mr. Benjamin said, the purpose of the presentation is to give the committee a review of the part of the capital program that was not previously visited, which projects that are not under Metro Matters. And we have visited some of them over the last few months, obviously stimulus, but let me go through that. And this is going to be a total picture. Let me start with the American Recovery. As you are aware, the ARRA has provided new funding capacity for Metro in the amount of $202 million. The projects listed in the subsequent slide are the projects actually that we've have authority for from our board and are in the transportation improvement plan. We anticipate the spending plan for these projects will probably occur mostly predominantly in 2010. About $130 million will be spent by the end of 2010. If you want to go to the next chart. Actually, this next chart, actually, you've seen before. These are the list of the projects that have been prioritized under the capital prioritization program that was put together by our planning group and lists out some of those projects. Next slide. As a result of the additional funding in the stimulus bill and the authority that the board has given to the general manager to develop and award these contracts, we've actually put together a few enhancements in order to accommodate for the many oversight bodies that we have regarding the ARRA funds. And accounting, budget, and procurement systems have been adjusted to recognize specific projects and their funding codes. We've made those changes on the front end of the initiation of a capital project. We've actually have bi-monthly meetings with the general manager to review the status of the stimulus and capital projects, and the grant office is developing monthly reporting mechanisms, which will eventually be published on the website. We're currently waiting for the grant awards, and we expect the appropriation or the approvals for those FTA to be next month. However, all grantees have pre-award authority for projects that are funded by ARRA. This just means that Metro can issue contracts currently, And we could expect reimbursement from the FTA for any costs that we incur as a result of that award. We expect to initiate a good bit of the awards, probably about $35 million worth of contracts sometime in June. In terms of other capital projects, these projects actually are referred to, they're predominantly reimbursable projects, and the definition that WMATA uses for reimbursable projects are projects that have funding arrangements that are separate from the primary funding arrangement that we have under the six-year Metro Matter agreement. And the most common projects are station improvements for access, and funding is typically provided by the jurisdictions. We've summarized in two categories. On the bottom, as you can see, we just gave you a picture of what it was from 1969 to the present, and that actually was mostly predominantly the construction of the system. And as you can see, the estimate, it was a budget authority, was almost $12 billion, and funding provided was about 11.5. But in terms of the top chart is more current. The last 10 years, we have about $1.6 billion of budget authority for reimbursable type projects, of which a little over $1 billion was funded to do those projects. This represents about 67 projects, capital projects, that we currently have in our program. And just to give you a sense, too, of what they are, if you can go back to that other page. Oh no, go back to that next page. I apologize. The District of Columbia projects, New York Avenue Metro Rail Station, D.C. Convention Center, bus garage contracts. Maryland predominantly was Largo Extension, New Carrollton Rail Yard expenditures, and then Virginia obviously was the Dulles Extension design build and preliminary engineering, Huntington Park structure, and then on a regional basis there was obviously the 6,000 series rail car procurement. So those would just give you a picture of what those projects were. Going forward, for the capital program that we will provide to the committee and the board to approve with the operating budget for FY 2010 in June will be a program that is not as disjointed as it has been in prior plans. It will be a comprehensive capital program that will include the last year of Metro Matters funding projects, as well as the stimulus capital program, as well as the what is known and the forecasted, hopefully reimbursable programs. So it'll be a comprehensive capital program which will have many different funding sources, and we'll be able to identify what those are. And to this end, actually, we are developing a website that's in development currently, typical of the website that you see with VDOT or MDOT, which actually is promoting the transparency that we would like to see in terms of capital projects, information, tracking, and reporting. We intend to bring that to the board in June for approval.
Ms. Kitchell, may I stop you there for a moment?
Yes.
Because what you said is very important. What you're going to ask us to do is approve a fiscal 10 element of a capital program. And although we've seen, I think, the Metro Matters portion of it, none of us has seen anything about anything else on it. So you're going to bring it to us and then want us to approve it right away. I was sort of hoping that we would see some of that today.
Well,
because we don't have a chance to look at it, discuss it, do anything until we get to the point where you have no time left to approve it.
Well, actually, just a point of clarification. The Metro Matters, which I had provided to the board at a prior meeting at the last year of Metro Matters, typically was mostly IRP, infrastructure rail program. That was the predominant expense that would be incurred under the Metro Matters agreement, and those are already approved projects under the Metro Matter agreement. The board has also seen the stimulus program and has provided the general manager the delegated ability to award and move on those projects. So what we will bring to the board are those two things which committees have already seen, but the addition will be actually a plan of contracts. And the plan of contracts will have the detail as to what we anticipate developing in an RFP and award ability under operating as well as capital. And the plan of contracts will actually provide you that level of detail to see how actually we plan to move in terms of award authority. typical in the past, the board has given us award authority to approve contracts under less than $1 million. This detailed plan of contracts that we propose to the committee will be requesting a higher level of award detail. And we will segment the projects in terms of these are capital projects that we typically do on a year-to-year basis, sort of like just standard operating procedure projects. Obviously, we will not bring to the board a plan of contracts that is a large project, the 7,000 series cars, for example. I mean, that will be something that will be looked at as a separate type of award. But that will be the nuance of this particular June request.
I think that's more than a nuance. I didn't quite get the answer I was looking for again. We are going to be asked to approve the fiscal 10 element of Metro Matters, which we've seen, of these other items where we haven't seen it. We've done a nice multi-year, but I don't know what any of this does in 1 year.
I might be able to help with that. Everything else has individual board approval. Classic example is the Dulles extension. It is a $250 million WMATA capital project inside the capital program that has standalone board approval behind it. So there's no further action required of this committee or the board at this time. If any one of those projects require reprogramming or a closeout, we bring those forward to the committee and then to the board.
So you're arguing there's nothing in this category that is part of a fiscal 10 approval, other than a bunch of contracts.
Correct, because they all have standalone approval. The neutral host project that Ms. Peck presented this morning is an example of that. It will be a fully reimbursed capital project that will go to the board for approval and then follow a path all the way to closeout. So there's no subsequent requirement of the board to come back and reapprove it another time.
No, but we often will approve a program and then we will approve the individual elements of that program on an annual basis. You're arguing that in this area we would not do that. In the area of what effectively is reimbursables and a couple of other odd assorted things.
Yeah, and they all have standalone agreements or board approvals behind them. There's no capital project out there that doesn't have some board approval behind it. What we're trying to do is just bring all this to the surface, because over the years, a lot of these projects get approved, and then we never talk about them again. We never see them again. So we're just trying, as we move beyond Metro Matters to the next capital program, we want to surface both the big, highly visible capital projects, but all the other projects that are going on in one total program.
So could we have a list of what all of those are that we have already approved?
Absolutely.
And the amounts associated with
Absolutely.
Them?
Absolutely.
On a multi-year basis?
Mm-hmm.
And could we get that substantially earlier than when we're going to be asked to approve it, like a couple of weeks instead of just on the Friday mail out?
We can provide it early, yes.
And similar thing, if you're going to give us an incredibly large list of your contracts that you want to have approval authority for, it would really be nice for us to get that early enough to really spend some time looking at it and not get it at the last moment. So if you could accelerate that and have it like a couple of weeks before a committee meeting.
I think we may be able to do that as well.
Are there other comments, Mr. Zimmerman?
I join you in that request, Mr. Chairman, but I'd like to get something of the relationship among the pieces that are in here. The winding down of the Metro Matters program and the current absence of any financing mechanism to take its place has compelled a ramping down of our annual capital expenditures that was displayed in the budget film that was presented at the beginning of this year, which reduced roughly a $600 million annual program to something like $450 million. And I assume that if we asked, you could show the things that we're not supposed to do this year as a result of that, that got pushed out of years and all that. That would be really interesting. And you could also show what the stream of capital spending looks like in the absence of that on a multi-year basis. Now, just after that, of course, came along the economic recovery bill and the $202 million of funding that we'll receive to basically in the same area. Now, I don't know exactly, but I'm assuming that this is mostly to be spent over 2 years. Some may go out, but most of it's probably the next 2 fiscal years. So that has some impact on that. And I'm guessing that in rough terms, we were down about $300 million over those 2 years, if it was
if the next year was looking anything like this year, capital, then it wouldn't go up, but I think it was around, I'll let you tell me, but assuming it was somewhere around that area, then maybe this has brought back about two-thirds of the capital funding we would have otherwise been able to do in this sort of biennium. Without necessarily getting into all the specifics of it here, this is the kind of thing I'd like to see clearly laid out, and the kind of thing that, Mr. Benjamin, I'd like to see one of us actually making the approvals, in part so that everyone can understand what's going on. It can become very confusing, especially to people outside of this room, but who need to know what Metro's financial and particular capital situation is. You know, you had this money, you lost this money, you're getting that money, you know, what have you got? And I think there isn't a good understanding of what it is that Metro has, what it needs, and what the difference is between the two. And all these different things that come in just add to what can become just sort of noise. And all people know is, yeah, Metro employees need more money. But I think it's important that we are able to show, number one, what has been happening. You know, we've had this projection of needs, which really hasn't changed very much. You refine and adjust the number, but the things we need to do, most of the big items are the same ones. We need to replace 300 rail cars that, you know, are getting to the end of their life, and a bunch of these other things. Most of the things in that list are, we're talked about here 5 years ago, 10 years ago, we've known we're going to need them. You know, whether it's rail cars or a paint body shop or any other stuff you need, you know, to run a transit system. But where they are, you know, changes depending on the funding picture. So, you know, in the short term, we have the immediate question so people understand what it's doing to everybody. Didn't you guys get that federal stimulus money? Yes. And it replaced some of the capital money that we were losing in our budget already, but not all of it. And, of course, that's very small when you put it in the context of 6 years out and 10 years out. Then, of course, there's the question of the federal money that they think we got and that some people think we're going to get. If we did actually get that money, what would that do? Well, I believe that would get us to within $3 billion of where we need to be, but still leave us about $3 billion in the hole. But again, I think in gross terms, it's not that hard to put that together in a way that would be easier for someone to understand. But it's really important that we straighten all these things out, because we talk about different time periods, different amounts, and all this. And we need to be able to lay it out in a way that everybody can get a clear picture of. Here's what are our now pretty well-defined needs at a period of time. Here's the money that we've had. Here's what we're assuming about what we're going to have, because some of these assumptions that are in this stuff, basically what we call baseline in some of this, really assumed that we were going to keep getting the funding from the local jurisdictions that we were getting during Metro Matters, which, by the way, we don't now have. And if you replace that money, we're still short X billion. And then if you get the full funding from this federal bill, that replaces some, you know, that gets you part of the way, and we're still short this. And we need to be very clear with everybody in the public, in the other governments, all around the region, here's what we can do with the money we have, here's what we can do if you give us this money, and here's what we can't do. Because this starts going into next year as, you know, right away, all the governments that fund us, the ones that actually do fund us, which is, you know, basically two states and local governments in Northern Virginia, are going to be planning their own budgets for the next year. And they need to know very early on, and we need to make sure they know very early on, what the implication of their assumption about what this agency is going to receive means for the budget we will be approving 12 months from now. And that needs to start in June.
I think what Mr. Zimmerman has asked for is we have in July an item on the agenda for setting priorities in our multi-year capital program. He's really asking for the context within which that will be done, and for that to be well-defined so that we understand not only what do we need to do, but how much of that can we do, and that's then the priority setting that we're going to be focusing on.
And let me say, Mr. Chairman, I think it's great to have that discussion in July because you always look for something to do in July. But the reality is nobody's paying attention to anything in July. We're actually approving a budget in June. And when we do that, we need to be saying exactly what it means for the next year.
I don't disagree with that. So you're saying you want this to be advanced to June as opposed to the context that we do the July exercise?
I don't know exactly what's meant to be done in July, and if we're going to get more into weeds in July, that's okay. But we need, I mean, these are really large numbers. These are the big gross figures. We need to have them laid out in a way very understandable that, you know, fairly smart people who don't come to meetings every week, if they looked at it, could get it.
How much do we have, and how much do we need, and where are we going in this?
And how does the short term relate to the out years?
Right. And I think one of the things that concerns me is we're not being very definitive, at least at this point, on the short term. You're proposing a major policy change in terms of giving you the authority to go into a whole bunch of contracts, and we don't even know for sure what it is that you're going to have there. So a lot of the stuff we need to see a lot earlier than we walk into a meeting, or a few days before a meeting, we get some paper and we have a chance to look at it. So these are critical issues for us to make decisions about them.
I can address Mr. Zimmerman's comment. Yes, we will have that early, Mr. Chair. And also, the last year of next year is our last year of our Metro Matters funding agreement. So it's constrained, as you know. And as a result of that constraint, we know what our funding level is. And we also know what those projects are that we will be doing. And we will show that early. In terms of your comment about the 12 months from now, we have already, as I had indicated at the last committee meeting, started the some of the discussions with our partners regarding the next funding agreements in anticipation that the Metro Matters agreement would be expiring by the end of next year. There has been a lot of discussion internally and externally to try to understand lessons learned on the funding agreement. We're convening a meeting with the financial and CFOs of each of the jurisdictions on June 1st. We have a meeting on the 28th or the 29th with the JCC to understand some of those lessons learned, because we actually are putting together the framework for that, and we know that some of that planning actually starts in the end of August or actually the fall in some of the jurisdictions in terms of planning for next year. So we are already anticipating that, and we actually intend to reach out to the board as well to understand the lessons learned and provide a framework for what the next funding agreement will be by September, I believe. So that's the ongoing forward movement that we already are anticipating.
Mr. Lynn.
Ms. Kissel, you mentioned earlier that you were going to have a website that would provide information in the spirit of transparency. How is that coming to the board? Is it you're coming with a finished product, you're coming with a notice to proceed? What is it that you said you're bringing something to us? What is that?
We can certainly, we have a website now, just a stimulus, because of the stimulus funds. It's not populated yet, but it will be. But that actually was the trigger for us to say, hey, let's be transparent about our overall capital program, similar to what VDOT and MDOT do. So we can certainly bring that to the committee and have your view on it and present it before we publish that.
No, you actually said you were bringing something to us in your statement.
I'm sorry.
Defining what that was.
I was actually talking more about the comprehensive capital program, the approval of the capital program for June, and once that was approved for FY2010, we would then publish that on the website, is what my comment
no,
was.
No, actually, I thought you said earlier when you mentioned the website,
yes,
you said you would be bringing something to the committee. Maybe I missed.
We're missing what?
You know, earlier, when you mm-hmm. talked about the website and transparency, I thought you said you were going to be bringing something to the board.
Okay.
I didn't know whether or not that was to build a website or to show us the website. Or
I may have misspoke. What I meant to say was that we would bring the capital program to the board, and then once that was approved, we would publish that on the website. So I apologize.
So the website exists already. It just hasn't been populated.
It has been populated. It's intranet, and it's been developed by our IT folks. And because we have a lot of oversight bodies, including the GAO, the federal government, and obviously right. our committees on the Hill. So,
okay. If there are no other questions, I'd, again, like to repeat that you're going to ask us to approve an awful lot of stuff with many, many dollars associated with it, and we haven't really had a chance to look at it and bring it to us very quickly. So please take as much of that as possible and give it to us several weeks ahead, not 1 week ahead.
We'll do.
Ridership and revenue, Mr. Harkin.
Good morning. It's kind of a formal process of reviewing the annual budget. Staff brings to the committee, just prior to the budget approval, the final update of the ridership and revenue forecasts. There have been years in the past where we've had some unanticipated ridership growth, and there's been an opportunity to pop some extra revenue in the budget at the last minute. At this moment in time, we are recommending that the current budget be held. We're not seeing any dramatic change in the ridership trends from what we originally assumed when the budget was proposed back in January. So I'll cut right to the chase. We'll go through some information here, but the recommendation is to not change the FY10 ridership and revenue forecast at this moment in time. Go to the next page. I'll briefly walk you through what were those assumptions, what continue to be the assumptions on Metro Rail. The very first row is the current budget. We're assuming 221.8 million rides taken on Metro Rail, $504 million in passenger revenue. The fare policy changes that the board approved, which were enacted in January of this year, were to stop what was called fare integration, which was something begun years ago where we were taking revenue that was collected on Metro Rail and give it to Metro Bus, and this just undoes that policy because we've implemented the balanced transfer policy, and you can just see the dollar sways there. The footnotes at the bottom are the key issues on ridership growth. For 09, we assumed a 3% growth factor. We're currently running just a little bit better than that. In FY10, we've got a 3.6% peak period ridership growth and slightly higher than that in the off-peak, and that's consistent with the trends that we've been seeing all year so far. Next page. It's the exact same layout looking at Metro Bus ridership and revenue. There's one additional row there right in the middle called Eliminate Paper Transfer. Discussions with the committee this year, we've made the assumption that the elimination of paper transfer will generate $10 million of new revenue in the budget next year. That's something that staff is monitoring at this time. We don't really have enough data to conclusively say what we actually are collecting at this moment, so we want to just hold with that current assumption and continue to monitor. The footnote on the bottom is the assumed ridership growth. Again, we had a 1% growth rate built into the 09 budget. It's forecasting to be a little better than that by year end, and we've got a 3% growth rate built into next year's budget. Looking at some of the fare policy changes that were enacted, we can provide you this update that we think those policies are achieving the goals that were established. When the policy change happened in January, the attempt was to begin minimizing the number of cash transactions happening in the system, and you can see the first bar on the left-hand side is an average of the cash fares paid for the first 6 months of the fiscal year. And then in January, the number of people actually boarding and paying with cash has declined. It went down a little more in February, and it seems to be stabilizing at a much lower rate. The offset to that is we've got more people using their smart cards. So the objective of the program was to get less cash transactions and more smart card transactions, and it seems to be achieving that goal. Similar to that, the policy change to eliminate paper transfers seems to be successful. Obviously, if you eliminate the paper transfers, they just stop appearing in the system. The little bar in January on the left was the first week in January, and then obviously in February and March, they don't exist in the system anymore, so they're at zero. And we now see more and more customers getting their bus-to-bus transfers by tapping their smart card. So again, I think we've got some success there. And then the last issue on the next page is an observation that our customers are very smart, and whenever we enact a fare policy, they will quickly find the fare schedule that is most beneficial to them. And here we have a situation where bus customers, perhaps using smart cards a little less than we thought, and what they're using are the flash passes. And, you know, every time somebody boards a bus, they do the math in their own head about what is the best deal for them. We've seen a slight uptick in the number of flash passes being used. Not a bad thing. It's just an indication that the customers are very well tuned into our fare policies and take advantage of those deals. So the conclusion of this is we think the fare policy changes enacted in January have been successful. They're achieving the goals that were set out for them. The revenue forecasts we have are pretty consistent. We believe they're reliable enough to keep into the FY 2010 budget. And staff is going to continue analyzing the day-to-day and month-to-month activities, and we'll report back on any interesting things we observe.
Let me just see if I understand it. Are you suggesting, does this suggest that there's a $23 million anticipated increase in rail revenue, rail passenger revenue?
Yes, sir.
But that, you don't see any need to revise the FY10 budget in light of that report today?
That is the FY10 budget.
So you're just simply confirming what is in the FY10?
Yes, sir. Absolutely. We're confirming
this
what's
currently. This is not any additional increase you're finding in either rail or bus?
That's correct.
So you're just confirming what's already going in the budget?
Yes, sir.
I think what I thought I heard was that although we're not quite at the points that would guarantee that, we're pretty close, and it looks like the budget estimates are not unreasonable ones. Is that
that's correct?
What you're trying to tell us?
Yes.
And I also heard the paper transfers is still something.
Not clear what those numbers are.
Yes.
Any other comments? Shall we move on to the financials?
It's really the similar story to what we just went through on ridership. I'll take you to page 97 of your package, which is a look at the ridership, average weekday and year-to-date. And at the top of page 97 of your package, you can see the growth rates, the year-to-date ridership growth rates on Metro Rail are at 4% over last year. Metro Bus is 2% over last year. Metro Access, as we've reported before, is coming in the low 20% range. It's a 22% growth rate over last year. Scrolling down to the bottom of that page, looking at the dollars of the budget, and you can see prior year actual revenue and expense, this year's actual revenue and expense, and budget all through year to date. Over on the right-hand side, we currently have a $9.5 million favorable result on the subsidy line, which is in keeping with the discussions the board has had previously about use of reserves, projecting this surplus to hold to year end, and under the current policy, that reserve that would be put into the reserve on a going forward basis.
Mr. Harcum, could you scroll back up?
Yes, sir.
The number that I found most significant in here was the Metro Bus monthly, which was down 1%.
Yes, sir. For the last couple of months, we've been noticing more and more volatility in month-by-month results on Metrobus.
Last month, it was up 10%.
Yes, which is hard to imagine. We've had a cross-departmental team literally tearing these numbers to pieces, trying to understand where the volatility is coming from. And I think we finally got there. There is no one answer. There are dozens and dozens of little answers. I'll give you an example right here. Looking at Metro Bus, why is it less than last year? We had a big snowstorm this March. And if you lose one or two business days out of Metro Bus ridership because the region has got a crippling snowstorm, you can see a 1% drop off in ridership. So I think on an actual to actual basis, 2 days of snow in March this year, where we didn't have 2 days of snow in March last year, can explain it. Rolling back to last month, one of the things you noticed was a change from February to February. Last February had a leap day in it. We had February 29th last calendar year. We didn't have a leap day this year. There was one extra weekday of ridership and revenue in last year's actuals that didn't show up in this year's actual. A day of bus revenue is $500,000.
Yeah, but that doesn't affect ridership and doesn't affect the fact that this year would be 10% higher, not lower.
No, I understand.
The other way around.
What I'm trying to indicate is there's no single answer to why something is up 10% or up 1%. We've got a list of, at this point, I think it's 22 identifiable things that have caused ridership and revenue variances. Not one single one of them is kind of at a policy magnitude thing to be concerned about in budgeting. What we want to do is continue watching it over a period of months, because if over a longer period of time, the highs and lows will start to offset each other. We're trying to understand the implication of the fare policy changes from January. So we had 3 weeks of January data, then you had February, and you had March. And all I'm trying to say is in that compressed window of time, things like a leap day or a snowstorm can dramatically influence these kind of outcomes. If longitudinally you extend that time frame and put another 3 to 6 months of data into that, a thing like a snowstorm starts to become just a small blip and it does not have that order of magnitude.
I don't disagree with anything you said. The thing that concerns me is we've had those kinds of things happen every year.
Agreed.
And the levels of variation that we're seeing this year are greater than we typically see. So I would still be hoping that there would be a broader explanation than there's a whole bunch of different things like snowstorms.
I can give you a
very unusual.
I can give you a sneak peek into next month. Yeah, we've already got preliminary ridership and revenue results for April. And what you're going to see, there was some charts in the back of the report. You see a graph that begins to trail off. Next month, it's going to bounce up dramatically. And what
bus
average fare, it's been falling in the back of this report pretty consistently for 3 months. The preliminary April numbers show it's bouncing back up. What we found is that in reassignment of buses as they move between garages, there's been some data tracking problems. Lacking the correct word for this, but we were meeting with one of the technicians the other day, and his technical phrase was a bus fare box went haywire. And we had one fare box report more ridership and revenue than an entire garage over a month could report. So what we're now having to do is go back through those individual weekly probe reports. When a bus pulls into a garage, you probe, you get the data out of it, and start trying to find, are there data errors? And it's just it's a very long, cumbersome, difficult manual process, but that's what we're going through. And I think over many months, we're going to come back and find out that, yes, in any one given month, there was something strange happening.
Let me add one other item that Mr. Harkin didn't. We have actually an accounting adjustment that we had not anticipated making because of some of the policy changes that we made in January. In terms of the fare card distributions that are now being distributed at other outlets, CVS and some other retail establishments. And because of that, that increase of sale of distribution of those cards is a lot more than we had anticipated. And the way we accrue or book revenue had not anticipated for that jump. And I think that accounted for...
That was almost $400,000 that you'll see next month. It's the Giant and Safeway consignment sales where we leave Fair Media at Giant and Safeway. Right. They sell it, and then we catch up with them at a future period and reconcile what they sold.
Are you talking about passes, or are you talking about smart trips, or are you talking about fare cards?
Everything.
All.
Well, except that we don't record sale of fare cards or sale of smart trips as revenue.
The passes do.
That's why I asked the question.
Right.
I mean, when you say to me what you just said, that doesn't relate to how we keep our books.
It was for passes.
It can't be a solution.
Yeah. It is for passes.
Passes.
And we're adjusting our accounting to accommodate for that. That's all. And that's another example of some of the changes that's happened.
Well, and again, you know, we have for years known that gate registers on rail go haywire and give very odd numbers. And we have for years adjusted for that and taken those out of the numbers. I believe we used to do that for bus. And now you're telling me that we're just discovering it. I'm a little concerned about what's going on there.
Well, this was one circuit board out of the thousands of buses that we have.
It isn't that. It's that that does happen, and mm-hmm. we know it happens, mm-hmm. and there needs to be a process in place to normalize for those kinds of problems, and we used to always do that.
It happened last month, and it took us a couple of weeks to figure it out, so we can try to reconcile quicker. To try to accommodate for
I'm
that.
I'm asking for an ongoing process. Mr. Green.
Right.
Yeah, I just want to, you know, demonstrate my keen sense of the obvious and refer to the growth rate in Metro. I don't know what the answer is here. I know I experience a lot of foot shuffle around these numbers. And maybe I'm one of the foot shufflers. But I want to make a suggestion, and maybe this is a step toward something more here. I want to ask the general manager for a very detailed analysis, I mean a real detailed analysis, over time, of what's happening in the program, how the free ride is working and not working. And give us some real thinking in terms of ways in which we can better understand this. I mean, I was recently at the Writers Advisory Council and again commented just how popular this is becoming. but it's a very expensive proposition. And I don't think, I think we need really that type of analysis. And we need it, I think, next month. Because I think, I experienced, I don't know about the rest of the experience, associated with certain roads in Maryland and what we've been recently through in terms of, you know, the use and the demand and the consequences there, you know, underscore all of this. And you know, I'd like to propose that type of analysis so we can see that.
Yes, we can bring that forth. In fact, we've done a majority of the work as we've given pieces of that, so we can have that available in June.
But I'm asking for more than the public. I'm asking also, it's been a little while since I've heard a really good report on the free ride program, you know, in terms of hard numbers. And certainly it would be very interesting for me to have a better sense of what's happening in other jurisdictions. I think that would be informative. But just the A to Z on this, so that we can, because I think if we're going to experience this and more,
I think what I hear Mr. Graham asking for is not necessarily tell us why, but tell us what.
Yeah.
What's actually going on? Where is it going on? Pull it apart and give us the pieces so we understand, you know, who's riding, where are they riding, what are they doing, what kinds of trips, and that kind of stuff.
And you know, I think if I could just add one thing, I know others want to speak, but if I could just add one thing. I think some real data in terms of our guidelines compared to the federal guidelines and the consequences of those two, the differentiation, would also be helpful. And I'm not interested so much in opinion as I am in data and analysis.
Ms. Hutchins and then Mr. Lynn.
I just want to have a clarity because I think it would be important if information is going to come back to us with something that will help us discern some of what we have some angst about. And that is, do we keep data on how customers move from the Metro Access system to the free ride system? Or is it actually a combination of them using both systems? Because if that data is there, that tells us something about how this number has some, or it doesn't.
And Mr. Lynn?
Well, you know, I think the data is very useful, and I think we've had bits and pieces of it in I guess, most recent presentations. I think one of the issues, though, and it always comes back to that, is the ability and desire, I wouldn't say ability, the desire to impose policies, to some degree very unpopular policies. Yes, there are, in fact, some things that we are doing that's beyond what the federal requirements are. But in my 10, 12, 13, 14 years experience with this, it always comes down to the unpopularity of going against those policies. For instance, if you were to, there's always an opportunity to go beyond what we're charging. Because in some instances we're not charging the maximum that's available under the federal law, which is twice the cost of bus and rail within a particular corridor. We could in fact do that. If you did that, then you have larger recovery. There are some services that we're providing. Well, but it is more than what we're getting now. There's also we're going beyond service areas. That's totally required, but we do that. So there are a combination of things that you could, in fact, do that we tend not to want to do. So those are factors as well.
Thanks, Mr. Zimmerman.
All that may be true, but beside the point, I think
we have an interest.
I think the point that Mr. Graham was perhaps making, what I was interested in was understanding better what is going on, why you have not just a year where you have an explosion of something, year after year after year after year after year after year after year. There isn't a time when this isn't growing at a double-digit rate. Well, very few things in life maintain double-digit growth rates. And when they are, you need to look at why. You need to understand better what's going on. And that's apart from any question of policies you might do to affect the cost of the program. You need to understand what is going on and why it is happening. I think that's what the question goes to, and I think we need to look at that, regardless of whether some of the things that have been proposed in the past to reduce the cost are things we would want to do or not.
Well, and I do think that this is a critical area in that, because of that growth rate, it represents the largest single contribution to our increasing subsidy. And it's one of those things that we really need to understand, because it drove an awful lot of the debates that we had in this room as we tried to close our subsidy gap.
Almost all of it, really, especially because of the impact on Maryland. But as it happens, I believe now that the cost of this, the subsidy for this program, is about, I think it's maybe now be more than half the subsidy on the rail program, for something like 0.5% of our riders. So, we can all say it's a great thing, we need to have it, it's important, but we need to understand what is happening. I mean, if I hadn't been here long enough, my inclination would be to say, how the heck are these people managing this program? How can it possibly cost this much? Unfortunately, I've been here long enough to see what looks from the outside like everything you could try. We send it out of house, we bring it in-house. We send it out of house, we bring it in-house. We fire managers, we bring in new managers. We fire those managers, we bring in new managers. I mean, I'm honestly not sure what, could be done that hasn't been tried already. But at the same time, I have to look at this and say, what is it? Is there something about the way the system is being done? Which is why I would like comparison. Not only, I want to see both over time, because everybody needs to see what's been happening over a lot of years with this. But I also want to see comparisons with other places. I know you talk to people in this industry, it's true that this is nationwide. But we still need to look at that, actually. And I have talked to places where they seem to have managed to do something differently and get better results both. Because one of the two constants in this is the cost grows like crazy, and the people who use it complain about how bad the system is. I mean, I don't ever go a month without hearing somebody tell me about how lousy this system is. Now, I will say less than I did a few years ago. It definitely does seem to have improved. There's no question about it. But I don't think I've ever seen a product that people buy up faster and complain about more at the same time. So, that tells me I don't understand enough. Even after all this time, I don't understand enough. And, I need to know better what the heck is going on, and I need to understand better. I remember some years ago seeing a presentation from somebody in Pittsburgh where they seemed to get some really good results, both in terms of improving the performance for the people who were using it and containing their costs. Now, I don't know what so there's a few places we might learn something from. Granted, they're not all comparable, they're not as big as we are, but we still need to understand what it is. And I want to see what's been happening. If the trends there, other than just the general statement that they're all growing, is the same kind of, are we really parallel to all the rest of them, or are we a little bit above or below or something else? I'd also look at what some of the in-region data is, because we're not the only provider. It's not only Metro Access. Part of the reason that Maryland was more hit on this than some of the rest of us were is Maryland is using it more. We have, that is, the other jurisdictions have other services. My jurisdiction, Fairfax, for instance, run parallel services. And we have cost increase, too. But if you really look at it, maybe we learn something. I don't know. But I'd like to see some comparison there of how it, what the experience is on these other systems.
We can also ask, and I'm asking for you all, why is Maryland using this? Well, why is a single jurisdiction
Part of it is that we don't provide as many supplemental. We're relying more on Metro, whereas in Virginia they provide their own service in addition to. And that's one of the things we need to look at. I think what we've said here is we do have an unfunded federal mandate. It's one that is very important. It provides services for people who absolutely need those services. But it's growing at a rate that's really affecting our ability to provide services to everybody. And we need to understand better what's going to be happening, why it's happening, and how we can keep this under control.
What were these people doing 3 years ago who are now using? What were they doing 5 years ago? I mean, have we had an explosion of people living with disabilities?
Aging of population.
Part of it is our aging. Well, what I would suggest is rather than having a discussion right now with the lack of the information that Mr. Graham's asked for, I think this is going to be a critical part in the development of our next budget. And along that line, I'd like to make one other suggestion. It's the same suggestion I made a year ago, and that is that we provide guidance to the staff in September for the construction of a budget, so that by the time we get to December and they're ready to put together a budget, they're doing something that reflects what we think is our ability to pay. Now, we tried that last year. It did not succeed. I'd really like everybody to think through again the potential to do it this year and work with the general manager to come up with a set of guidance that will focus this budget on what we can afford and what we want to stress and where we want to go with the budget.
Me too.
So I'd like to. I figured you'd agree. Mr. Lynn.
Before you leave the topic, I just wanted to suggest, and I think I've suggested this in the past, that and I think one of the things that was said by the gentleman from Arlington is that, you know, this is a nationwide problem, and it is. You know, I think it would be helpful for us to get the data that's been requested by Mr. Graham. But I also think that in light of the fact that we have a reauthorization that's before us, and they're calling it authorization rather than reauthorization, which should mean something. But if it means authorization, then this should be part of what we're talking about, and that, you know, I think, Mr. General Manager, we need to make sure that it becomes part of the discussion of the authorization committee in terms of how we are currently dealing with it's in facts in terms of the growth and the impact that the growth is having on all the transit agencies across the country, and put that on the ticket for the federal government. Because it is, it's an issue that I wrestled with for 7 years. But, you know, since it originated there, at least a significant part of the solution should be there.
We will do so.
I did want to note for Mr. Graham that once again this report indicates a substantial shortfall in parking revenues compared to budget, as we seem to have gotten to the point where the resistance to paying more is very high. Are there any other items you want to bring up in the monthly report?
No, sir.
Then this meeting is adjourned. Oh, wait a minute.
I just want to note something. About 2 hours ago, we passed a action item. Or an energy swap, or actually electricity swap.
Yeah.
I'd like to know, are we going to be able to get any more heat in this room?
That's part of the reduction.
That's part of the reduction.
Otherwise, we might want to come back to that item.
This meeting is adjourned.